I will call to order this remote meeting of the House Commerce Committee and ask Mr. Brown to take the roll.
Chair Stevenson.
Present.
Vice Chair Cortese Watoon.
Present.
Representative O'Driscoll. Representative Barr.
Present.
Representative Carlson.
Present.
Representative Daphne. Representative Elkins.
Present.
Representative Haley. Representative Cagle.
Present.
Representative Lee.
Lee present.
Representative Lilly.
Lilly present.
Thank you. Representative Lislegard.
Lislegard present.
Representative Lucero.
My coffee's not done brewing yet.
Representative Olson.
Present.
Representative Farr.
Present.
Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen present.
Representative Richardson.
Present.
Representative Tice.
Present.
Representative O'Driscoll. Representative Daphne. And Representative Cagle. I see Representative O'Driscoll present. Is here.
Yes, Representative O'Driscoll present. And Chair Stevenson, check your text message in a few minutes. Thank you.
Will do.
I'm present too. Did you get me?
Gotcha.
Thanks.
A quorum is present. We will move to our first item on our agenda, which is the approval of our minutes from yesterday's meeting. Vice Chair Cortese Watoon, have you had a chance to review the minutes?
I would move the minutes, Mr. Chair.
Any discussion to the Cortese Watoon motion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes from February 23rd, 2021 are approved. We have a packed agenda, so we'll get right into it. The first bill on the agenda is mine, so I will hand the virtual gavel to our Vice Chair Cortese Watoon. But first, noting that it is her birthday, so the committee wishes a very happy birthday to Vice Chair Cortese Watoon. It's a notable birthday. I'm pretty sure, you know, you're 25, right? You can rent a car?
Yes.
I was going to say 24, Mr. Chair.
I am old enough to serve in the House of Representatives.
Excellent. Well, right. The gavel is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the birthday wishes. So we'll return to our discussion of House File 1183 that we laid over yesterday. Chair Stevenson, will you move and start your bill anew?
So I will move that House File 1183, as amended, be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Health, Finance, and Policy. And I believe we had a good discussion about the overview of the bill yesterday.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Procedurally, the motion should be to pick it up from the table because that's where it was laid. So it needs to come up from the table, and then the motion would be in order. Sorry.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Chair, do you like to we'll pick up your bill?
Yeah, it was not laid on the table, just as a matter of clarity. It was laid over. So the motion to refer to a committee is in order. There's no need for a motion to take it off the table. So I have my motion before the committee, and I'm very happy. I think we had a good discussion about what's in the bill yesterday, some good testimony. Good discussion of amendments. I'm very happy to take any questions and participate in any discussion among committee members about the bill.
So members, any discussion on House File 1183? Seeing none. Mr. Chair, would you like to renew your motion?
Representative O'Driscoll has just raised his hand.
Right. Yeah, I believe that Representative Haley has just joined us. And if I recall yesterday, she did have her hand up on this. And I believe Representative Rasmussen had his hand up. And as whipsaw as things are, I'm just double checking to see if they're present in committee here today as well. So I want to make sure that they have the opportunity to ask questions if they did. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, and Mr.
Certainly. Chair. Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Representative O'Driscoll, for reminding us and making sure that everyone is present before we move on too quickly. Representative Rasmussen, I see your hand in the air.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'll direct my question to the bill author or perhaps anyone else who can answer it in our committee today. I know this bill prohibits manufacturers from deciding to withdraw drugs from markets in Minnesota because of the cap on price increases. And I was wondering if the bill author could shed any light on how, you know, the Attorney General would prove that a company is withdrawing to avoid the price increase caps versus just withdrawing for another reason. And my concern with that is, could it essentially scare away companies from offering their products here in the state of Minnesota because they could be worried about getting into a legal action by the Attorney General if they decided for whatever reason to withdraw from the Minnesota market?
Chair Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Rasmussen, thank you for that excellent question. And I do, for the committee's benefit, believe we have someone in the committee today from the Attorney General's office. And I'm not actually aware of who that, the name of that person, but I believe there is someone available. The thing that I would say is that I note that the withdrawal to evade the action by the Attorney General would presumably be preceded by action by the Attorney General. And so I think the Attorney General would be able to establish the basis along that lines. I do see—
Mr. Chair, it looks like Carly Milleen has joined us.
Yeah, I do see that Ms. Milleen is here, and I don't know if she is the person who would be answering questions today or if someone else is, and I don't know if she heard Representative Rasmussen's question.
Ms. Milleen?
I did, Madam Chair and Representative Stevenson. Also on the call today, we have Assistant Attorney General Jason Plagenkuhl. He manages our civil division, so he's able to take that question.
Thank you, Ms. Milleen. Mr. Plagenkuhl, please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jason Plagenkuhl. I'm the manager of the Consumer Wage and Antitrust Division with the Attorney General's Office. And to address the question, my reading of the bill is, you know, the Attorney General's Office would have to be able to prove by a preponderance of the evidence to a court that was the reason for the withdrawal from the state. And so it would require investigation and sufficient evidence to establish that reason or motive for withdrawing.
Representative Rasmussen, follow up.
And would there be any color you could provide on what that evidence would look like and how we would differentiate that from just, you know, other commercial reasons for a manufacturer from exiting that market?
Mr. Plagenkuhl.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. It's hard to say in a vacuum what it would be, but it, you know, typically our investigations would include taking testimony under oath and depositions. So it could be admissions in a deposition. It could be email or other documentary evidence we obtain as part of an investigation. So we would ask for relevant emails and other communications about the withdrawal. And that could shed light on motive as well. So it really kind of depends on the circumstances and what evidence exists.
Representative Rasmussen, any clarification?
No, thank you, Madam Chair.
Very good. Representative Haley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to ask the author, Chair Stevenson, to give some more information. You had mentioned a court case and as the reason why you changed your bill in your DE to have this just applied to generics. Can you describe that in more detail?
Chair Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Haley. Yeah, my rough understanding of that court case is it comes out of the federal circuit and it's relates to the supremacy of federal patent law and some federal preemption and indicates that we wouldn't have the ability to regulate in the fashion this bill intends. But I don't know, that also might be a situation where Mr. Plagenkuhl might be able to shed some light.
Mr. Plagenkuhl?
Madam Chair, Representative, happy to do that. That's an accurate characterization of the case. The case dealt with a District of Columbia statute that was passed seeking to prohibit unconscionable price increases for patented prescription drugs. The case was then transferred to the Federal Claims Court on appeal because it has exclusive jurisdiction over patent law. And that Court of Appeal held that the DC law was conflict preempted by federal patent law, giving patent holders an exclusivity period to benefit from their patents. And so while our office disagrees with that case, it's an unfortunate decision. It is an impediment that exists towards being able to regulate patented drugs in the same way this bill is seeking to do so for generics.
Representative Haley.
Thank you very much for the response. And I had just a couple follow-ups, whether this is for the author or the Attorney General's office. Yesterday, I'm looking at my notes, the Attorney General referenced the need for this bill and he used insulin as an example. And certainly what happened to some residents in Minnesota with insulin is very tragic. So I wanna make sure I mention that. But this bill would not address brand insulin, to my understanding. So if I misunderstood that, maybe you can correct my memory of that discussion yesterday.
Chair Stevenson.
Well, Representative Haley, Madam Chair, Representative Haley, I wouldn't presume to speak for the Attorney General directly. I would note that I think the bill is clear that it applies to generic and off-patent drugs and not patented drugs.
Okay. Representative Haley?
Thank you. I guess that kind of clarifies. My understanding is it would not, you know, impact insulin prices. So I just wanted to be clear on that for the public. And then a final question for the author, Representative Stevenson. The bill also requires that manufacturers that do business in Minnesota would have to have a registered agent or office in Minnesota. And I'm wondering if there's precedent in our statute for other products, if it's manufactured products or other medical products, that language basically can be upheld in court.
Chair Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Haley, you know, I think that I might refer that question to House research about whether there's a precedent with other areas that that relate to that. I certainly know that it is very common for entities that do business in the state of Minnesota to have registered agents, and it's certainly a sound business practice. But I would ask Ms. Pompeo if she could comment on that.
Looks like Ms. Pompeo is with us.
Chair and members, I can't think of a specific example relating to manufacturing, but I can certainly look into it and get back to you, Representative Haley.
Representative Haley, any further follow-up?
No, thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to ask those questions from our previous committee hearing. Thank you.
Certainly. All right. Members, any further discussion of House File 1183? Seeing none, would you like to renew your motion, Chair Stevenson?
Madam Chair, I would renew my motion that House File 1183 as amended be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Health, Finance, and Policy.
Good. Chair Stevenson renews his motion that House File 1183 as amended be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Health, Finance, and Policy. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Stevenson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Cortizo Watun.
Aye.
Representative O'Driscoll.
No.
Representative Barr.
No.
Representative Carlson.
Yes.
Representative Davney.
Aye.
Representative Elkins.
Aye.
Representative Haley.
No.
Representative Cagle.
Aye.
Representative Lee.
Lee, aye.
Representative Lilly. Representative Liz Lagarde.
Aye.
Representative Lucero.
No.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Farr.
No.
Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, no.
Representative Richardson.
Aye.
Representative Tice.
No.
And again, Representative Lilly.
Sorry, Lilly, aye.
Thank you. One second.
There being 11 ayes and 7 nays, the motion prevails, and House File 1183, as amended, is recommended to be referred to the Committee on Health, Finance, and Policy. I will now hand the virtual gavel back to Chair Stevenson.
Thank you, Vice Chair Katiza Watu. Our next bill on the agenda is House File 686, Representative Eklund's bill. Representative Eklund, welcome to the committee. I will move that House File 686 be laid over for additional consideration. As I understand, the author is still working on the bill. Representative Eklund, if you could describe your bill for the committee.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a delete all amendment. I would like to get the bill in shape. I want it in first, and I have Ms. Joyce Pepin to explain the delete all.
Absolutely. So I will move the delete all amendment, which is the A21-0037 amendment. And Ms. Pepin, if you could describe the amendment.
Will do. Happy to be here. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Joyce Pepin, and I represent the Minnesota Rural Electric Association, and I'll quickly go through the sections of the Delete Everything Amendment. Paragraph C, for starters, confirms that electric co-ops may use their electric transmission or distribution easements for broadband infrastructure, but only after providing notice to the landowners. Paragraph D describes the written notice requirement, specifically that the notice has to be sent via first class mail or bill insert to the property owner. State the purpose of the easement expansion is to provide broad, describe the nature of any trenching or underground work needed and the anticipated timeframe of each work, of such work. And paragraph E recognizes a landowner's right to commence legal action to challenge use of an electric easement for broadband or seek damages for such use within 6 months after notice from the cooperative. Paragraph F describes what an electric co-op can and cannot do if the property owner, if a property owner files a court action. Paragraph G incorporates Minnesota's common law on damages under which the property owner has the burden of proof and damages are equal to any decrease in the fair market value of the property. And paragraph H expressly recognizes that the bill doesn't affect a cooperative's existing easement rights. So those are the main sections of the bill. And I think Representative Eklund mentioned that the purpose of this bill, the main purpose is it's meant to help bridge the urban-rural divide by facilitating the ability of Minnesota's nonprofit rural electric cooperatives to use their electric easements and fiber infrastructure to improve broadband access for rural Minnesota. So that covers the author's amendment, and I'm happy to take any questions now or after the rest of the testimony.
Well, thank you, Ms. Pepin. I think we can first get this author amendment on the bill to get the bill in the shape the author would like the committee to consider it. Is there any discussion to the A21-0037 amendment? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails and the A21-0037 is adopted. Representative Eklund, did you have comments that you'd like to make as author of the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Real briefly, House File 686 is a bill that would allow Minnesota's electric cooperative utilities to use their electric easements for broadband. As we all know, broadband connectivity has become more important than ever for communities across the state, especially for our rural communities. This bill is intended to help bridge the urban-rural divide by facilitating the ability of Minnesota's rural electric cooperatives to use their electric easements and fiber infrastructure to improve broadband access for rural Minnesotans. It would only allow use of these electrical easements where the use is not already expressly authorized by an easement or other agreement with a property owner. After notice to the property owners where the easements are located, and it recognizes the rights of these landowners to challenge the use in court. With that, Mr. Chair and members, I do have a couple of testifiers.
Excellent. We will go through the testifiers. I have the first testifier on the list is Brian Crambier from My Energy Cooperative. Mr. Crambier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm going to try to share my screen, if that is okay. There you go. Are you member able to see that, Mr. Chair?
Not yet.
Okay. I am Brian Cranbeer, President and CEO of My Energy Cooperative in Rushford, Minnesota. Some of the basics of My Energy are listed there for your information. A couple points that I would like to point out is 5,500 miles of electric distribution line, and our average member density is 4 members per mile of line. The electric industry is changing immensely, and we are deploying significant technology in order to operate our electric distribution system. And this continues to build from AMI to energy management to even GIS technology of our entire infrastructure. And the future continues to change with EVs, battery technology, and the list continues. All of this is becoming information for our electric co-op to manage data and information, not only from our substations, but also real-time data from our members. We used to utilize a microwave communication system. We also utilized cellular VPN, but the expectations were limited, and it was also expensive. Rushford, Minnesota is down in southeastern Minnesota, and you can see here from the map, we have no service or very limited service in much of our service territory. That is what prompted us to partner with two neighboring telephone cooperatives to form My Broadband. Spring Grove Communications and Mabel Cooperative Telephone were natural partners for My Energy in delivering broadband. We've been extremely progressive in our efforts, but we have a lot of work to do. There are 44 electric co-ops in the state of Minnesota, 5 of which are providing retail broadband. But again, many of these co-ops are deploying infrastructure, much like My Energy, to manage this data. There are also numerous generation and transmission cooperatives throughout our state that are also working to utilize fiber technology. And there's one GNT in the state of Minnesota that has over 500 miles of overhead fiber already. Cybersecurity is very important. We need to own the infrastructure, again, with this fiber to be able to manage it and secure it. But there is a tremendous opportunity to lease this fiber, strands of this fiber, to third parties to be able to provide broadband, retail broadband service to all corners of our state. But we cannot lease this fiber to a third party unless it has the new easement permitting to allow a third party to be able to utilize that. Electric co-ops have been in business for over 80 years. Most of our easements date back to the 1940s and 50s, and they're provisional. We also have a lot of non-resident landowners, making it very difficult to communicate with them. The new easement adds considerable time to the broadband build-out. My Broadband has been in business since 2018, and no member has opposed the broadband build-out, and they're grateful to have access to quality broadband service. It's certainly neighbor helping neighbor, and all of my Broadband's fiber to the home is buried underground. That concludes my comments, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cranbeer. The next testifier on the list is Scott Reimer of Federated Rural Electric Association. Mr. Reimer.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Chair Stevenson and committee members. I am Scott Reimer. I'm the CEO at Federated Rural Electric, headquartered in Jackson, Minnesota. We have an outpost in Welcome, Minnesota, and serve roughly 6,700 members. Thanks for the opportunity to register our support in favor of this House File 686. Sponsored by Representative Eklund. Federated has service in Jackson and Martin counties, as well as fringe counties, including some in Iowa. I know time's tight for you, so I'll get right to the point. This bill is very important for us as it will help alleviate at least one known barrier in the deployment of high-speed broadband. In 2020, just to give you a little history, Federated was approached by one of the local telcos that currently do broadband, and they saw the need for broadband in the greater Jackson and Martin County areas. So the two of us got together and we attempted to get into the RDOF auction, which we did. However, that auction didn't turn out like we had expected. So now we are still committed to the deployment. However, we're looking at new options to do so. Our plan would have provided fiber to the home high-speed broadband to anyone who wanted it, really, but specifically those that were unserved or underserved. Currently today, we've brought in at least one more partner, so we have a lot of good success out there. Like Brian had indicated, cooperatives have been in the business for a long time, Federated since 1935. We've got, you know, thousands of miles of line out there that we've already got right-of-ways and accesses to most, if not all, of the people who would get choose to get service from the fiber. But I think the entire country, including Minnesota, has had the mindset that we need to close this digital divide. So comes many challenges with the economics, the infrastructure, but the easement plays a very critical role. Most of the people that we talk to simply ask, why is it taking so long? You know, we've been waiting for this for years. And of course, if RDOF would have played itself out, that could have been underway this year, but I think that's probably going to be delayed. But what we'd like to do is continue on with the broadband deployment with our partners and ask for your support as it comes to the easement bill that's in front of you today. As Brian mentioned, his customers per mile were at 2.5. So clearly we don't see a lot of large telcos coming to our area to serve rural America, rural southern Minnesota. So that's something that we've been willing to take on. We did it back in the 30s with the electrification of the rural areas, and we're more than willing to do it again today with the broadband technology. So I just want to close echoing my support for the bill and thanking you all for the time. And I'd love to answer any questions that you might have of me. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Reimer. The last testifier on the list is Tony Mendoza of the Minnesota Cable Communications Association. Mr. Mendoza.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. Tony Mendoza on behalf of the State Cable Association. I do have a slide to share as well. I'll give it a shot. Can everybody see that?
We can.
Just a quick drill, and I know time is limited. I represent the State Cable Communications Association. I appreciate Representative Eklund bringing this bill forward and his willingness to continue to work with us. This bill raises a couple of competitive concerns for cable companies and the Cable Association. We think any competitor entering the broadband market should play by the same set of rules. That includes co-ops. And I just wanted to point out that competitive issues regarding co-op entry into the broadband market are being negotiated in other states and should be worked out among the stakeholders in Minnesota as well. All broadband providers, including cable providers, presumably have rights to dedicated public utility easements. These easements have been in place, as was alluded to by an earlier testifier, for decades or otherwise have been granted by state law. The distinction here is that broadband providers must also negotiate their own private easements. And under House File 686, co-ops are asking the state to force property owners to expand the scope of their private easements without negotiation. This provides co-ops a major competitive advantage in serving rural areas. It also raises constitutional takings issues, which my longer slide deck, which is I think posted on the committee's website, describes in further detail. Those competitive issues are very important to the Cable Association because we do serve rural areas ourselves. But the final competitive issue that's raised by the entry of co-ops into the market is the issue of pole attachments. Co-ops and municipally owned utilities are the only monopoly owned owner of utility poles that aren't subject to some form of pole attachment rate regulation. In many areas, many rural areas, co-op-owned poles are the only way for competitors, including cable companies, to access rural broadband customers. In other words, because they own a bottleneck facility, the co-ops already have a leg up on the competition in these areas. And just to demonstrate the magnitude of this problem, there was a study done in an FCC docket a couple of years ago that compared the rates that are charged by investor-owned electric utilities whose rates are regulated for pole attachments and compared those to the rates that co-ops charge. In Minnesota, you can see that the rates charged by co-ops for accessing poles are quadruple, double to quadruple sometimes the rates that are charged by investor-owned utilities. We have one example from a member in Minnesota in which the same exact poles were owned by a private utility. They were sold in some sort of a merger or acquisition transaction to a co-op. And for the exact same set of poles that were the investor-owned utility was charging $4.81 per pole. When the poles came under ownership of the co-op, the price per pole per year went to $13.50. So these are issues that we would like to work out with the co-ops, and we look forward to working with Representative Eklund and the co-ops to make this bill better and something that serves all of the competitors in the broadband industry equally well. Thank you.
All right, we will now move to member discussion and questions. I have a question, if I could, for Ms. Pepin. The prior testimony kind of made it sound, at least to me, like the co-ops just have these easements, but it kind of, to me, raises the question of how did they get them in the first place? How did co-ops acquire these easements?
Sure, I'm happy to answer that. Thank you. Well, electric co-ops that have been in place since the 1930s, and so some of the easements are very, very old. And so they have gone out and gotten those easements, and this is just to serve a dual purpose for broadband. And I would just say that that our rights are actually far less in statute than cable companies, because ours are, right now we don't have the ability to use our own easements for broadband purposes, but the cable companies can actually use their easements or any utility easements. So that's why this bill, we are working very hard to make sure that we're addressing all the due process requirements and the takings issues, and hope that gives a little bit more context.
Yeah, and just to follow up on that, I guess, in other words, the easements at the co-ops own, they negotiated and provided compensation to the landlord before, just a long time ago, right?
That is correct. And this would just allow for a dual purpose of broadband infrastructure. So you are exactly right on that. Thank you.
All right. Representative O'Driscoll.
Mr. Chair, I defer right now to Representative Lucero. I just like to that clean up with a couple of other suggestions for the bill author.
We will certainly indulge your desire to back cleanup. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the bill author. And I appreciate both former Majority Leader Pepin, the conversation we had, as well as the cable lower hand there. Okay, trying to multitask. It was a great conversation, and I am definitely torn on this particular bill, and I am very happy that it is the motion is to lay it over to allow some further conversation. So as a technologist, obviously, voice and data communications is incredibly important. I think we've all seen, just with the distance learning here, how incredibly important, just overnight, the need for access to broadband is. And we live in the digital information age. And those that don't have access to it, I don't know how long it's been since anybody even on this call has had to wrestle with 56K dial-up and having to download or bring an email or open a 1 meg attachment over a small pipe, 56K dial-up. It is incredibly frustrating. But trying to do distance learning, obviously over access. I recently had the displeasure of acquiring a property that didn't have internet of any kind. And I had to use tether my cell phone. And the hotspot became my data communications and internet access for the entire house. It wasn't pretty. So I very much am in favor of the need to expand the use of that in these rural areas. And that's what this would do. On the other side, I very much understand and am receptive to the takings. I'm receptive to the competitive disadvantage that this would cause. And I think the poll issue highlighted there is definitely one. And then the conflict of interest, just because what would be happening is the cable and others would now have a competitor that they are on the same polls of that are owned by the co-op. And again, these are all questions I'm glad it's going to be, but I have no doubt that there will be the ability to rectify these for the betterment of all parties. So thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Representative Eklund.
Representative Lucero. Well, I don't see anyone else other than Representative O'Driscoll, so I think this is now the bottom of the ninth. I don't know if the bases are loaded, but our cleanup hitter, Representative O'Driscoll.
But I don't think the score is tied either, so I think most people have gone home and gone to bed already after the ballpark let out here. I want to thank former Representative Pepin. I know that she's kind of been caught in a tough spot on this particular item, given the fact that, as Representative Lucero pointed out, there's been a very large pent-up demand, and many of us have heard that in our districts, for internet service, because we went literally on a dime from being able to be in the classrooms, being at work, to needing to rely on the internet. And I've had a lot of people in my district who have shared their thoughts and comments on the issue. So Representative Eklund, thank you for bringing this bill forward. I think it's an important consideration. I would suspect that today there is no one who would say they're not in trying to get internet access to these homes that have limited ability, or to these businesses that don't have access. My concern is been expressed here, and I will just underscore a taking for people. I did look at the bill language. We're getting better on how we would rectify this, but I just really have a problem with putting into statute something that would be ripe for litigation. So I'm hoping that we can get this resolved so we don't have a litigious situation on here. We've had a former member in our chamber who's now a senator, who is now my senator, who has been caught between three different carriers, and he falls into the gray zone. He is not able to get access, and he's frustrated. And I know that he's not the only person, so I'm very sensitive to the issue. Representative Eklund, I did share with Ms. Pepin some concerns I have on notification. So I would invite you to get with her to talk about how to notify individuals of the desire to put bring internet to fruition in these easements, how to notify current property owners, some different ways to be able to do that. And I'm glad that we're laying this over so we can get the issues resolved, because the last thing we want to do is have something that's going to be off the governor's desk being signed and into the court system being challenged. I think that cooler heads can prevail on this, and we can find an equitable resolution to this. And again, I'm somewhat torn on this because I do respect property owner rights. I am involved in this personally and professionally outside of the legislature. And so I do value individual property rights. We're getting there, but I don't know that we have it. I think laying over the bill and working on this with other stakeholders is the right thing to do at this time. So Mr. Chair, thank you for letting me bat clean up. I don't know if I've batted in any runs to settle the score for the game, but nonetheless, I think it is important that we continue to work on this. It is a noble cause. It is a worthwhile cause. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Driscoll. I do see that Ms. Pepin is looking for recognition. Ms. Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee and Representative O'Driscoll. I just wanted to hit on a couple points about what needs to be worked out here. And so I guess I'd like to hear more feedback on that. I'd also like to just briefly talk about the pole attachment issue and how that's we've talked about it, whether it's a competitive issue or not. I just want to clarify that we're trying to make a very narrowly focused bill. This is strictly about easements. The pole attachment issue, there's a million issues to talk about there. There's a reason the FCC removed co-ops from the standard pole attachment fee requirement. There's all sorts of safety issues. There's the fact that the rural collector co-ops are very densely populated, and therefore the costs can be subsidized by other electric co-op member owners. And so those are just a couple issues, but that's a very, very different discussion. And so I hope that isn't hindering the bill. That has absolutely no place in this bill whatsoever. And then just regarding the takings issue, just for your consideration, I just want to point out a couple things. First of all, I would say that in Minnesota case law, it's established that an easement holder is not limited to the particular method of use when the easement was first acquired, and that other methods to use in aid of general purpose is allowed. So that's been established in Minnesota case law. And then I'd also say, just regarding takings, to authorize a taking, legislation needs to provide both substantive and procedural due process. And I believe that our bill does both. A substantive is requires that it be for a good public purpose. And I think that everybody would argue or would believe that broadband throughout the state of Minnesota, especially in times of COVID, is extremely important. And additionally, you've identified broadband as having a state goal to provide universal high speed. So I think it meets that requirement. And then for procedural due process, the author's amendment requires what's required in law is a pre-deprivation notice and opportunity to be heard. And we've done that in this amendment. We've given 6 months notice and then a whole process for damages and how they're to be notified. And so we feel like this bill is in pretty good shape. So if you do have thoughts over how to, that you think that would make this stronger, we're definitely willing to listen to them. But I just wanted to point out that we feel like this bill is in pretty good shape from that point of view.
Okay, well, thank you, Ms. Pepin, and I'm sure Representative Driscoll and others on the committee have concerns. We'd be happy to communicate with you about that offline. Representative Lucero, did you have something you wanted to add?
I appreciate the indulgence, Mr. Chair, and I'll make it real quick. I just wanted to add, Ms. Pepin, reminded me of something I forgot to mention. That is, I have actually experienced laying this down. So where there's an existing easement that has been negotiated decades in the past, I have very little concern regarding the intrusiveness, if that might be a concern for some, because when laying fiber down, right, it's a very narrow, depends on how they're going to do it, right? But it likely they wouldn't do a single strand, which would be incredibly small, but they'd probably do something about, I'm guessing the size of maybe a silver dollar pipe with that would protect the fiber. But the way that they can bury this is that it's something that sits on top of the earth. They don't actually have to dig a trench. They can bury this stuff or they can bore it through existing, and obviously properties will have different unique circumstances, but the intrusiveness or the invasiveness would be minimal to zero in the case where it has to be buried. In the case where it would be laid across pipes or poles, it would be, again, likely very minimal to non-existent invasiveness using the existing easements. Again, just emphasizing, I see both sides of this, but it is something that I think overall will benefit once we can come to a final product. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Well, I think that concludes the member discussion on the bill. Representative Eklund, do you have any closing comments?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, members, for the discussion. I've been working on this bill pretty much since we got down here this year, and I've met with many of the stakeholders, and I have many more meetings to try to clean up some of the questions here that we're talking about. I want the members to know, in my district, District 3A, approximately 82% of the households are co-op members. And our cooperatives are shining examples how we can provide broadband in the state, and I'm gonna do my best to make sure that the members of my district, or the households in my district, have a chance for it. So I'm committed to keep working on this going forward, and I appreciate the committee's indulgence, Mr. Chair.
Well, thank you, Representative Eklund, and we on the Commerce Committee really appreciate your willingness to continue to work with the stakeholders to find a solution that works. With that, we will House File 686 as amended is laid over. Next on the agenda, we have a set of bills that all are similar in that they relate to mandated coverage. Before proceeding to the bills directly, we are going to hear from a testifier from the chamber who opposes, as I understand, all four, or wants to be heard on all four bills. Instead of coming up four times to give the same message, we offered the opportunity to a couple people to come up just once at the outset in the spirit of efficiency. So that's why we're going to hear from Mr. Bentley Graves first. Mr. Graves.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members, and I appreciate the indulgence and the efficient approach to this. But my name is Bentley Graves. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. We represent 6,000 employers across the state, in all corners of the state, all industries in the state. 80% of our members have 100 employees or less. So the vast majority of members are small and mid-sized employers, and of those who offer coverage to their employees, health insurance coverage, the vast majority are in the fully insured market where they are buying coverage for themselves and their employees. 3/4 of our members, in our annual survey said that, if and as costs continue to increase as they have been, that they will be forced to make pretty substantial changes to their benefit offerings, including, up to and including dropping the coverage altogether. And in fact, we're seeing that to some extent already from 2018 to 2019, which is the most recent year for which we have data. We saw a drop in participation in the small group market to the tune of right about 2,000 groups. So that's, 2,000 employers that left the small group market. Now, some of them may have grown and moved into the larger group market. Some may have moved to self-insuring, although the data underscore that, there was no kind of wholesale shift from one to the other. And one of the biggest challenges that faces small and mid-sized employers is the issue of cost. Unlike large employers who self-insure their coverage and their offerings to their employees, and do so under federal rules under ERISA, small and mid-sized employers who are participating in the fully insured market, purchase that coverage and are subject to the various state regulations around the offerings that they can purchase and therefore offer to their employees. And that includes a number of state required mandated coverages. And Minnesota actually has one of the longest lists already of mandated coverages in the country of around 60. And all of those, are there for a reason. None of those are there by accident. They all offer some help and some benefit to Minnesotans, but they also all come with some costs. Academic research has indicated that the average benefit adds anywhere from about a half to just over a percent in premium costs every year. And that's the struggle when these mandate proposals come up. And it's one of the reasons why we have worked with Senator Benson in the Senate and Representative Elkins in the House on legislation to try and provide a greater emphasis on the kind of the cost benefit analysis of weighing out these mandate proposals as they're brought forward. We understand, this is a difficult decision for everybody. For you all sitting there, for the advocates, for those of us who are trying to advocate on behalf of the payers on the other side of this equation. But we believe that the legislation like has been introduced by Representative Elkins really could offer the legislature and all stakeholders a much better sense of how to work out the cost and benefit trade-off associated with these mandates. So it isn't just kind of, every time, one of these is brought forward, it's me or those like me sitting here saying, don't do this because of the cost implications. But knowing that I'm sitting, virtually, I guess, in this case right next to somebody who would be, very much beneficially impacted by the passage of these mandates. So it is very much a tension and very much a struggle. But nevertheless, given some of the statistics that I offered, both as it relates to our members and the broader market for small and mid-sized employers, who we all know are very much struggling with the issue of cost. It's nevertheless incumbent upon us to provide that perspective to you as you go into the discussion about these different mandates. Again, I very much appreciate, from you, Chair Stevenson, the indulgence and the opportunity to kind of speak broadly about this. And I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Graves. I think we will move to the individual bills at this point, but if members wanted to direct a question to Mr. Graves during any of these bills, they should feel free to do so. The first bill on the agenda is House File 56 from Representative Elkins. Representative Elkins, would you care to move your bill?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move that we refer House File 56 to the Committee on Health, Finance, and Policy.
Representative Elkins moves that House File 56 be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Health, Finance, and Policy. Representative Elkins, to your bill.
All right, thank you very much. I'm going to keep my initial comments very brief because we have an outstanding testifier today that I want to give most of my time to, and I will have some concluding remarks at the end. But we have with us today Dr. Nancy Hutchinson, who is in the Cancer Rehabilitation and Lymphedema Practice at Courage Kenny Rehabilitation Institute of Alina Health. And she specializes in the treatment of lymphedema. She's worked in the field for over 20 years, solely in the care of cancer and lymphedema patients for about two decades. She's one of the premier experts in the country on this topic, and so I would like to give the floor to Dr. Hutchinson as quickly as I can here.
All right. Well, in that case, Dr. Hutchinson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. It's an honor to be here. Thank you very much for allowing me to testify in support of House File 56 coverage of lymphedema treatment. I am here as a subject matter expert. I am not representing Olina Health or any other organization. These are my opinions coming from my experience as a physician. I specialize in the treatment of lymphedema, and I have taken care of hundreds of patients with lymphedema over the past 20 years. The reason that I wanted to have the opportunity to talk to you today is that lymphedema is a much more complex condition than most people realize. A mandate to cover treatment is needed because the condition is serious and it's very misunderstood. Lymphedema is really a misnomer. The lymphatic system is the immune system in our tissues. What is seen as swelling is actually the buildup of toxic inflammatory substances that lead to serious infections, wounds, pain, deformity, and disability. So lymphedema really correctly should be called lymphatic organ failure. At the time it was named, medical science was rather primitive and didn't really even understand the lymphatic system, so they called it lymphedema. Lymphedema therapy, known as complete decongestive therapy, prepares an affected body part for the fitting of a specialized lymphedema garment that replicates non-functioning lymphatic pump mechanism. So complete decongestive therapy is very different from massage or elastic compression garments. And over the years, as I've tried to provide letters of medical necessity for my patients, I am often given the reason for denial that these materials are things that are readily available in a drugstore, like an ACE bandage or doing a massage. This could not be farther from the truth. As a matter of fact, these other types of things that people might try to use, like an ACE bandage or massage, are actually harmful to lymphedema. And the problem is that they look very much like lymphedema treatment. So the massage is not massage. It's called manual lymphatic drainage. It's a specialized technique. Therapists have to go to training for it. It actually stimulates the lymphatic system. It's a skin stretch. It takes a lot of skill. The bandages are not ACE bandages. They are short stretch bandages with a very different tensile strength. And the compression garments are not elastic. Elastic constricts like a rubber band. The compression garments have a high tensile strength that contains the extremity so that when the person moves, it simulates the lymphatic pumping action by muscles pushing up against a rigid container. So as such, lymphedema garments actually meet the definition of a prosthesis according to the Social Security Act, which defines a prosthesis as devices that replace all or part of an internal body organ, the lymphatic system. In the 20 years that I have cared for patients with this terrible disease, I have seen needless suffering. I've had patients caught in the revolving door of hospitalizations for serious life-threatening infections, needing more and more high-powered antibiotics. Patients with wounds requiring expensive prolonged treatment, and patients with severe pain and deformity of their limbs from inadequate treatment, all of these are preventable. And in 2016, I submitted to you an article in the packet that I sent before this testimony. An analysis was done of over 10 years' experience with a lymphedema coverage mandate in the Commonwealth of Virginia. And the analysis showed that the cost of lymphedema treatment was found to be insignificant as a percentage of claims. Office visits and hospitalizations for lymphedema and lymphedema complications were reduced. Therefore, a coverage mandate for lymphedema treatment just makes sense for patients and payers alike. And that concludes my comments. Thank you very much for allowing me to speak.
Thank you, Dr. Hutchison. And Representative Elkins, you mentioned wanting to be your own cleanup hitter here. If you have very brief remarks.
Very brief,
amendments and discussion.
Yeah, so As Mr. Graves pointed out, I am also the author of House File 55, and I kind of hope that we could have heard those two bills together. I have some issues with 55 that I need to work out with Chair Liebling. Yesterday, she made some comments indicating that she's concerned in particular about a proliferation of many LBO fiscal note type processes. So I'll need some time working on 55. But what I like to say really is that I would not have brought 56 forward if I did not believe that it would have met the requirements of 55. The key requirement in 55, which is a bill to that would require some objective analysis of these mandate bills, the key requirement is that scientific information must be provided that includes the results of at least one professionally accepted and controlled trial comparing the medical consequences of the proposed therapy, alternative therapy, and no therapy. And clearly, the study mentioned by Dr. Hutchison clearly meets that mandate. So whether we were hearing 55 and 56 together today, 56 clearly would meet that the mandates of that bill if it were to pass. And I would not have brought this bill forward if it did not meet that standard.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. We will move to the amendment next. But before we get to that, I neglected to say at the outset that we're considering these four mandated coverage bills on a policy basis today. They conceivably could have fiscal costs to the Department of Commerce and thus be part of our budget. And so if they do have a fiscal impact, they will have to come back to the Commerce Committee. But all of these bills have other committee stops to make. So we're sending them out so they can make those other policy stops. And then if they have fiscal impact, we may consider them again in the Commerce Committee. And I also did make a request of all of the testifiers and bill presenters to keep their presentation of the bill to 5 minutes, which I forgot to mention before Representative Elkins started his presentation, but he did keep it to 5 minutes. So we will try to follow that rule with the other three bills. There is an amendment, Representative Rasmussen, you've offered the A1 amendment. Would you like to move and describe it?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll move the A1 amendment to start our discussion today.
Great, and to the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I cannot take credit for this amendment today as it's Representative Elkins, House File 55, that's been discussed by Representative Elkins and also Mr. Graves from the chamber. I guess imitation is the most sincere form of flattery, so I hope Representative Elkins takes this amendment as a sincere compliment for his thoughtful bipartisan work on health insurance mandate reform. And I think that's not only reflected in House File 55, but also the underlying bill, House File 56, that he has taken a very thoughtful approach on with this bill. So today we are going to be hearing a number of bills that propose benefit mandates on the fully insured market. And as a member of this committee, I feel unprepared to vote on a number of these bills because we don't have enough information to understand the full impact these bills will have on Minnesotans. And Representative Elkins' bill that I'm offering as an amendment would make great strides in helping the legislature evaluate and understand the consequences of new benefit mandates. The bill would require the Commissioner of Commerce to conduct an evaluation on new benefit mandate proposals before they're heard in the legislature. This evaluation is comprehensive, including information on the benefits' clinical efficacy, how many Minnesotans would be impacted, the extent of which insurance coverage for these benefits is available, and lastly, the cost of the benefit, both in terms of enrollee premiums and the cost to the state. When the legislature votes for more insurance mandates, as Mr. Graves said earlier, the cost of health insurance tends to go up. Minnesotans deserve a thoughtful process that takes into account both the human impact, which we will hear today, of these mandates, in addition to the actuarial impact that will ultimately show up as increased health insurance costs for Minnesotans. Representative Elkins' proposal will give the legislature a robust evaluation process that will allow us to make more informed decisions. We have an opportunity today to advance a bipartisan proposal that will reduce the cost of health insurance here in Minnesota. I would humbly ask Representative Elkins to consider this as a friendly amendment so that we can move forward with this important reform and this important discussion. So thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to explain my amendment. And I would just simply ask for the final word on this amendment after member discussion today.
Of course. Representative Ellens.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I remain committed to the principles behind House Bill File 55, and but what I would prefer to have time to continue to move it as a separate bill. You know, speak with Chair Liebling, others who have concerns with it, and before you know, making another big push to have 55 heard on its own. But I would much prefer to do that rather than have it attached to a particular one of these bills. As I said in my earlier comments, I'm confident that House File 56 would meet the requirements that are put forth in 55, and I think it should be allowed to be able to move on its own merits.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I want to thank Representative Elkins for House File 55 as well, and Representative Rassman for offering it as an amendment so we can have an important discussion today. In my years at the Minnesota Legislature, and particularly on the Commerce Committee, we do get a number of requests from time to time to include additional conditions, ailments, maladies and the like as a part of mandated insurance coverage. And the unfortunate part about it is not all of the individuals who are on the committee necessarily know what those issues are, the scope of those issues, those conditions. And if you have a personal connection to it, it's certainly something that you would want to support. And I think that House File 55 takes the emotion out, takes the political part of the process out, and it says we're going to evaluate each of these different requests on their own merits based on how we go through this criteria. And I think it's rather disingenuous if members of the committee at that time in the makeup have an understanding of a particular ailment or malady, and then they say, yes, let's include it. But there's another worthy one that people aren't familiar with, which gets a pass or doesn't get included. I think that that Representative Rasmussen is absolutely onto something, and Representative Elkins, you are the first to bring it. I think it's a good bipartisan. I think we're reaching out here in good faith to look at wanting to do something so that we can take the emotion out, we can take the politics out of this, and we can actually do a process that is good for Minnesotans. And so I support the Rasmussen Amendment today. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I don't see any other discussion. Representative Rasmussen, you asked for the final word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Elkins, for your commitment to continue working on this on House File 55 in conjunction with the other health insurance bills that you're working on this session. I was wondering, Mr. Chair, if either you or Representative Elkins had any insight onto when and if we would be able to get a hearing on House File 55. I know it has received the companion bill has received a hearing in the Senate and has had a wide bipartisan support, and so I was wondering if you could offer some light on how you're thinking about House File 55 fitting into our work this session.
Thank you, Representative Rasmussen, for the question. Happy to provide that context. Since it, as you just said, was heard in the Senate, of course, that means it's made first deadline, and so we have until March 19th to hear it in the House. As Representative Elkin said, he continues to work on the bill, I know there are members who have questions about the bill. I've had discussions with members who have questions about the bill. So I don't haven't made any firm decisions, nor do I have any firm plans at this point, except to say that I recognize the hard work that Representative Elkins has put into the bill, and it would be my intention to support Representative Elkins going forward and continuing to work on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Rasmussen. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that commitment to continue working on this bill, and I would also be happy to be helpful in any of those conversations going forward. I've had a chance to talk earlier this week with Representative Elkins, and just his background and thoughtful analytical approach to health insurance matters is much appreciated by me, and so anything I can do to be supportive of that effort, I'm willing to be a part of. So thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Elkins. And with that, I'll withdraw the A1 amendment.
Thank you, Representative Rasmussen. And we certainly appreciate your willingness to be constructive and helpful on these issues. Representative Rasmussen withdraws the A1 amendment. Is there further discussion to House File 56? Seeing none, Representative Elkins, very, very, very brief closing comments.
It's a good bill. We should vote yes.
All right. And with that, Mr. Brown will take the roll.
Chair Stevenson.
Actually, before you do that, I need to renew the motion, I think. So I will ask Representative Elkins to renew the motion. My fault.
I'll reiterate the motion that we advance this bill to the Committee on Health, Finance, and Policy.
All right. Representative Elkins renews his motion to advance the bill, to recommend the bill be referred to the Committee on Health, Finance, and Policy. And now Mr. Brown will take the roll.
Chair Stevenson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Cortizo-Watoon.
Aye.
Representative O'Driscoll.
No.
Representative Barr.
No.
Representative Carlson.
Aye.
Representative Dabney. Representative Elkins.
Aye.
Representative Haley.
No.
Representative Cagle.
Aye.
Representative Lee.
Lee, aye.
Representative Lilly.
Lilly, aye.
Representative Lislegard.
Lislegard, aye.
Representative Lucero.
No.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Farr. Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, no.
Representative Richardson.
Aye.
Representative Tice.
No.
With 10 ayes and 7 nays, the motion prevails, and House File 56 is recommended to be referred to the Committee on Health, Finance, and Policy. The next bill on our agenda is House File 626. Representative Ryer, welcome to the committee. I will move that House File 626 be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Health, Finance, and Policy. And Representative Ryer, the floor is yours to describe the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. It's a pleasure to be here. House File 626 focuses on broadening access to provider networks for diagnosis and treatment of rare diseases. This bill has bipartisan support in both the House and the Senate, and I'm pleased to present it to you today. Rare diseases are defined as those that affect fewer than 200,000 people in the United States. At this low incidence, very few providers, even specialists, see many cases of each disease in the course of their career. Because of this understandable lack of familiarity, it can be frustratingly difficult to get a diagnosis for a rare disease. Here are the numbers: an average of 8 physicians before a diagnosis is received, 3 misdiagnoses, and 7 plus years until diagnosis. These numbers are especially noteworthy when you consider that many with rare diseases are children who spend much of their childhood trying to get the correct care. Providers with expertise in these conditions are scattered across the U.S. in a host of medical centers. As stated in a report from the California Healthcare Institute, since expertise for any rare disease could be limited to a handful of physicians, these patients must often go out of network to receive the standard of care. This bill would make it easier for patients and their families to access the actual services they need. Given the complexity of the healthcare system, there are plenty of nuances to work out. The Advocacy Committee, health plans, and I have been having productive conversations about this, and I'm confident we'll be able to finalize a bill that achieves our intent and addresses this important healthcare need. Next, you'll hear from Dr. Art Bison, complex care pediatrician at Gillette Children's Specialty Healthcare, bringing the expert's view of the need for this bill. I look forward to your questions and ask for your support.
Thank you, Representative Ryer. Dr. Bison.
Good afternoon, Chairman Stevenson and committee. Thank you for letting me speak today. As we said, I'm Art Bison, I'm a complex care pediatrician at Gillette Children's Specialty Healthcare. At Gillette, we take care of kids with rare diseases, lots of neurologic rare diseases, and traumatic disorders. We have our main clinic here in St. Paul, Minnesota, but we have clinics throughout the state to support our patients. We take care of patients in every county in Minnesota, most of the states in the United States, and several other countries. People come from all over for our care. My job as a complex care pediatrician is really to help families coordinate the care for their children with rare diseases. It is not uncommon for my patients to need 5 to 10 subspecialists to make sure that they're getting the care they need. And in addition, probably another 5 to 10 various therapies that need to be coordinate. So it's a big job, and it's really hard for families to get the care they need, and it's almost impossible to get that care within one care system. The other issue that I've learned through the years is many of my patients with rare diseases, as you heard previous, is they take a long time to get to diagnosis. And when that happens, there's a lot of morbidity that occurs. They are in much worse shape, end up with a lot of hospitalizations. So if we can get to kids and have a diagnosis much earlier, we actually improve their health care, improve the quality of life for their whole family, because this really is a whole family issue. And in many cases, it saves the healthcare system quite a bit of money, because we don't have a lot of emergency admissions to hospitals, things like that. So early treatment is really important in being able to get to the experts that can do that. Diagnosis is really important. I just want to give you a couple examples. Kind of a classic example that we see a lot at Gillette Children's is spinal muscle atrophy. And that's a disease where children are born with very weak muscles, including the diaphragms that support movement of their lungs. Many of these kids have multiple pneumonias the first year of life. Fortunately, there have been some wonderful breakthroughs in therapy in the last couple of years that allow these patients to have much more strength. And if we can get to early diagnosis and get to the right specialists, we can start treating these patients, and they end up having much improved quality of life, staying at home, going to school, and their parents are able to maintain their jobs and much better quality of life with fewer hospitalizations. So that's an example of a real success story with a rare disease with diagnosis and treatment. Earlier this week, I saw a patient.
Dr. Bising, I'm sorry to interrupt, but we are running a little short on time, so I have to ask you to wrap up your remarks if you could.
Okay, I won't tell you about my next patient then. But basically, I support early diagnosis and getting to the care kids need early, and it saves everybody money. It makes kids healthier and families happier. Thanks for letting me speak.
Thank you very much, Dr. Bising. The next testifier who signed up is Mr. Matt Schaefer from Medica. Mr. Schaefer.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Matt Schaefer. I am the Government Relations Director for Medica, a Minnesota-based nonprofit health plan that offers coverage in 9 states. However, today I'm testifying in my capacity as a member of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. I want to start by thanking Representative Ryer for her willingness to work with the council. We've had a couple productive conversations, and hopefully we're able to achieve some common ground. However, we do have some concerns about the bill as written that we'd like to get on the record. For beginners, as Minnesota-based nonprofit health plans, we believe we already do this. We believe we're required under 62K.10, subdivision 10 at the state level, to find care for an individual who requires treatment that's not available within their network. We make this available for people regardless of whether they have a rare disease, and we are currently working with the author to see if there are any gaps within those state, within those that market that can we can mitigate. The second piece is we're concerned the scope of this bill might be a little larger than 200,000 people as referenced in 111 and 112 of the bill. According to the NIH website, which actually houses that list cited in the bill, there's actually a list of 7,000 diseases. And when you look at those, you'll find some such as melanoma, ovarian cancer, formaldehyde poisoning, the measles. And it states that there are about 25 to 30 million people who may have a rare disease. So it's a pretty broad scope. And that site itself is actually was designed to categorize drugs, not necessarily people. And so we've been interested in knowing if there might be a better list to work from. Third, the concern we have is with carve-outs like the one that's listed in 1.17 and 1.18 of this bill. And we're continuing to see the trend of carving out individuals on public assistance and are concerned that this continued practice is going to create two separate standards for Minnesotans with private insurance and Minnesotans on MinnesotaCare and medical assistance. That concludes my remarks, Mr. Chair. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, sir. We'll now move to member discussion and questions. Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess maybe Mr. Schaefer already addressed this, because my question is, in dealing with my medical issues and also some things that my husband has, we ask our doctor for referrals and go to different clinics to get the treatment that we want. What is different from that to what's being talked about today in the bill?
Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Tice, I would say that it's a matter of degree, perhaps. If you're talking about being within a known network, there still would be restrictions, but we're talking about an out-of-network coverage required.
Yeah.
We're talking about a situation where these subspecialists and these experts, we're a handful of them in the country, are treated as in-network, and they have broader access to them. Otherwise, these families are going to have extremely high costs for this care that's routine for them because of the nature of their conditions.
Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know what you're talking about, but I'm talking about the same thing. There have been times when we've gone out of network for different treatments that we would like to have and have done the referral system. And I guess I'm just unclear why it would be different if it was a rare disease. I guess I'm thinking that it is already there, that we have an opportunity to do that. Are people just not aware that that is something that they can do, is ask their doctor for a referral? I know a lot of folks that have different ailments and they go to the Mayo, for instance. How does that work and why is this different?
And Representative Tice, I think perhaps it'd be the bill is going to come back to this committee if it proceeds forward because of the fiscal cost. And we have a couple other bills on the agenda. So I'm going to encourage you and Representative Ryer to maybe have an offline conversation about about your concern, if that's okay with you. I just want to make sure we get through our agenda today, the bill will have to come back here eventually. Is that all right with you, Representative Tice? Thanks.
That is fine, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Representative Farr?
Yeah, so if I'm reading this right, the bill exempts coverage provided through a medical or a public health care program. And why are they treated differently than those that are purchasing insurance on the individual market? Or where, why the difference there, Representative Ryer?
Representative Ryer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Farr. That is one of the points that we are talking through. I have also come to agree that we should be looking more broadly and that there is in the course of doing more research on the people who are affected, I think there are a lot of people who, because of the cost of a disease like this that's so hard on families and the ability to make a living, there are many people with rare diseases who are on public programs, including a constituent of mine who I spoke with just last week. And so to me, that's one of the pieces that Mr. Schaefer was referring to that we're discussing.
And I would just add that the bill is going to go to the Health Finance Committee, which has jurisdiction over those public programs. And so I'm sure that conversation will continue there. Representative O'Driscoll, if you have a brief question or comment.
Mr. Chair, I am going to just make a comment that will apply to this bill and the two remaining bills that we have. Our members will probably not be supporting any of the three remaining bills today. And it's not because of the merits of the request. It's the process. I think that with Representative Rasmussen coming forward with House File 55 as the amendment, that we've made our point as to why we would be supportive of this. We don't feel it's a job of the committee to be picking winners and losers at this point in the process. So I recommend a no vote, not for the malady or the disease on this bill and the remaining bills, but because of process. And Representative Ryer, thank you for reaching out to me as well. I greatly appreciate that. Mr. Chair, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Driscoll. Representative Ryer, any brief closing remarks?
Only to say that I appreciate your support, because I think it's important that people who feel excluded from getting the care they need, whether or not logistically there would be a way, we know how hard it is to deal with the healthcare system, and I think that we need to take out barriers. So I appreciate your support.
All right, and with that, I will renew my motion that House File 626 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Health, Finance, and Policy, and ask Mr. Brown to take the roll. The chair votes aye.
Chair votes aye. Vice Chair Katiza-Watoon.
Aye.
Representative O'Driscoll.
No.
Representative Barr.
No.
Representative Carlson.
Aye.
Representative Dabney.
Aye.
Representative Elkins.
Aye.
Representative Haley.
No.
Representative Cagle.
Aye.
Representative Lee.
Lee, aye.
Representative Lilly.
Lilly, aye.
Representative Lislegard.
Lislegard, aye.
Representative Lucero.
No.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Farr.
No.
Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, no.
Representative Richardson.
Aye.
Representative Tice.
No.
With 11 ayes and 7 nays, the motion prevails, and House File 626 is recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Health, Finance, and Policy. Thank you, Representative Ryer. The next bill on the agenda is House File 447. Welcome to the committee, Representative Akam. I will move that House File 447 be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Health, Finance, and Policy. And Representative Akam, if you could describe your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There is a slight amendment that we were going to do in an oral amendment, maybe. I can always do that in the next stop if you
prefer. Can I suggest, given the time, that we do that in the next committee stop? Thank you, Representative.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the Commerce Committee. Thank you for the opportunity to present House File 447, a bill to improve breast cancer screening. Dana Carter with the Susan G. Komen Organization was planning to be here to testify in support of my bill, but unfortunately had a family emergency and is unable to attend. She has instead submitted her written statement for the record. As many of you know, breast cancer is one of the most common forms of cancer affecting women. In fact, 1 in 8 women will be diagnosed with breast cancer at some point in their lifetime. In Minnesota, 4,850 women will be diagnosed with breast cancer, and 640 will die from the disease this year alone. Treatments have improved greatly over the years, but the best way to ensure a positive outcome is early diagnosis. Our society recognizes the value of early breast cancer diagnosis for women. Currently, U.S. guidelines recommend regular preventative mammograms as part of the preventative and wellness services included in the 10 essential health benefits. These essential health benefits outline the minimum requirements for health insurance, and these screenings are typically provided at no cost. Sometimes, however, regular mammograms may show an area of concern and require additional testing. Even though necessary to achieve a conclusive determination, these follow-up procedures may not be fully covered by insurance like the initial mammogram. This appears to be an oversight in the intent of the current law that this bill seeks to address. I have seen this problem myself firsthand. In the past, I've been flagged and brought back for follow-up testing after initial mammograms show an area of concern. When this happened, I remember the scheduler calling me to set up the appointment and telling me I would need to pay $150 for the follow-up procedure, even though the first mammogram was free. I questioned her on that, since the doctor was saying I needed the second test to fully evaluate my screening. She said it was due to my health insurance, but that I was worth it. I did think I was worth it, and I believe all women are worth it. But the goal of free preventative screenings is that the cost should never be a barrier to women finding out if they have breast cancer. I am a breast cancer survivor myself, and my success is largely due to early diagnosis and treatment. I want all women to have barrier-free access to early diagnosis. I would ask for your support of House File 447, and I stand for questions.
All right, there are no testifiers who have signed up, so we'll have member discussion and questions. Any discussion or questions to the bill? Representative Katiza-Watoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Acomb, for bringing this bill forward. I'm so glad that you are here and sharing your experience and speaking out for all women in Minnesota. Thank you.
I don't see any other members seeking recognition. Representative Akam, any very, very, very brief closing comments?
Thank you. Please support the bill.
Representative Akam, I will renew the motion that House File 447 be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Health, Finance, and Policy. The clerk will take the roll. The chair votes aye.
Chair votes aye. Vice Chair Katiza Watun.
Aye.
Representative O'Driscoll.
No.
Representative Barr.
No.
Representative Carlson.
Aye.
Representative Daphne.
Aye.
Representative Elkins.
Aye.
Representative Haley.
No.
Representative Cagle.
Aye.
Representative Lee.
Lee, aye.
Representative Lilly.
Lilly, aye.
Representative Lislegard.
Lislegard, aye.
Representative Lucero.
No.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Farr.
No.
Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, no.
Representative Richardson.
Aye.
Representative Tice.
No.
There being 11 ayes and 7 nays, the motion prevails, and House File 447 is recommended to be referred to the Committee on Health, Finance, and Policy. Thank you, Representative Akam. The last file on the agenda today is House File 785. Welcome to the committee, Representative Freiber. I will move that House File 785 be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Health, Finance, and Policy. And Representative Freiberg, if you could briefly describe your bill.
Thank you. Could you also move the DE1 amendment to put it in the shape I would like?
I will move the DE1 amendment, which is an amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like the committee to consider it in. Is there any discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say no. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Freiberg, to the bill.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson. I know you're pressed for time, so I'll keep my comments exceptionally brief. House File 785 would require health plans to cover acupuncture for the treatment of pain and pain management when performed by an authorized acupuncture practitioner. In light of the opioid epidemic, we need to encourage non-opioid pain management options, and acupuncture is an important option. I have had a few testifiers signed up. They were going to keep it to 5 minutes, although I realize that might be even too long. So I think I will just ask Paul McGee to testify, and he'll speak to the evidence that supports acupuncture as a pain management tool. Many insurance companies do cover acupuncture, but the coverage is inconsistent. It's important that a baseline of coverage be in place so that patients can access this potentially life-saving medicine. I have been in discussions with the health plans regarding this bill, and the author's amendment is an attempt to address some of their concerns. With that, I'd like to turn it over to my testifier, Mr. Paul McGee.
All right, Mr. McGee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Paul McGee, and I'm a licensed acupuncturist, a member of the Minnesota Acupuncture Association, and I work as one of the lead acupuncturists for the Allina Health Group. Although like Dr. Hutchinson today, I'm here representing myself. I'm speaking today in support of House File 785 because I believe that consistent insurance coverage for acupuncture would be a significant step towards improving the current opioid crisis. I will briefly discuss two studies, which are on the committee's website. While acupuncture's benefits for chronic pain have been well documented and insurance coverage is better with chronic pain diagnoses, our ability to treat acute pain is less acknowledged by insurance payers. There was a study in 2016, which was a comparison of acupuncture versus intravenous morphine in an emergency room setting, in which acupuncture was shown to control pain better, faster, and with significantly fewer side effects than the morphine. As a note, acupuncture has been used in local hospitals for several years to help control pain, and the results are comparable and have led to shorter hospital stays, which reduce costs. We also did a trial of acupuncture in our emergency room a few years ago, but could not make it sustainable. One of the barriers we encountered was the lack of consistent insurance coverage. The second study is on the general safety of
acupuncture. Mr. McGee, I'm sorry, I'm gonna have to ask you to wrap up your remarks.
All right, in my experience, we already have enough buy-in from both patients and physicians to start building programs that would make impacts on the amount of opioids being prescribed. What we lack is the consistent coverage. And thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. McGee. Before we move to member discussion, Representative Rasmussen, I know you had an amendment that you filed, but I maybe understand that you aren't offering it. Is that correct?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Out of respect of our time and our prior discussion on House File 55, I'll withdraw the A1 amendment.
Thank you, Representative Rasmussen. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to briefly give kudos to Representative Freiberg. I am a huge believer and consumer of acupuncture. It has done great work. I am going to pass on voting on this bill. Are we laying this over or have we moved on?
It's moving on.
Okay, so I'm going to pass on it just for the fact that I do have a competing interest here. I don't like putting more mandates on insurance companies at the same time. I'm a huge believer in this. I can firsthand testimony. I wish we had more time. I could explain it. But at the time when I did have an insurance company that did actually allow, and I don't know if I want to name them, but it's one of the big ones that actually did cover acupuncture. So I know that insurance companies have the ability to negotiate and come to a private sector agreement on this. So that's why I'm going to vote pass, just because I don't want to place mandates, but at the same time, I don't want to vote against it. So thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Freiberg.
And Representative Lucero, I just have to clarify, you were never an acupuncturist, right? This is not a new job. Is that
correct? Not yet.
There's still time. Okay, Representative Freiberg, any brief closing comments on the bill?
It's a great bill. Please support it.
All right. And with that, I will renew my motion to re-refer House File 785 to the Committee on Health, Finance, and Policy.
From that standpoint, that's why I prefaced it the way that I did.
I think Representative Driscoll accidentally unmuted himself. So I will renew my motion to refer House File 785 to the Committee on Health, Finance, and Policy. And Mr. Brown will take the roll, and the Chair votes aye.
Chair votes aye. Vice Chair Katisa-Watum.
Aye.
Representative O'Driscoll.
No.
Representative Barr.
Pass.
Representative Carlson.
Aye.
Representative Davney.
Aye.
Representative Elkins.
Aye.
Representative Haley. Representative Cagle.
Aye.
Representative Lee.
Aye.
Representative Lilly.
Aye.
Representative Lislegard.
Lislegard, aye.
Representative Lucero.
Pass.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Farr.
No.
Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, no.
Representative Richardson.
Aye.
Representative Tice.
Aye.
Representative Haley.
No, thank you, Simon.
With 12 ayes and 4 nays, the motion prevails, and House File 785, as amended, is recommended to be referred to the Committee on Health, Finance, and Policy. And with that, our business for the day has concluded, and the meeting is adjourned.